Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Laszlo Bock, he heads the people operations, I guess that's a fancy new word talk for HR, at Google. And he just wrote a book. It's called Work Rules, nice pun. Sometimes work does rule, but it's about work rules. Anyway, about how to motivate employees, how to pick employees, how to be a good employee. Of course, most companies don't have the fiscal or human resources to do all that Google does, but the book does offer lessons that we all can use as individuals, as managers, even of a one-person business or a tiny nonprofit. With me to discuss the book Work Rules is someone who does work at a more typical place than Google, the Napa County Office of Education. Her awards are too many to mention, so I'll just say that she was Regional Superintendent of the Year. Barbara Nemko, welcome to the show. I should mention you're my wife. Oh, yeah. Are you there? We're having a little technical problem. She was on the line a second ago. Is she? Let's double check here and see what's going on. Okay, we don't have her on the line. Okay, let me give you her number, and then you'll call her, and then we have another guest here so that we can switch things around here. Okay, I'll just give you the number. Do you want me to just give you the? Well, okay, one second here. Sorry, dear listeners. Live radio, that's what happens. What can I say? Okay, here you go. All right, so what I'm going to do is, while I'm waiting for the call, is this. This is the worst possible way. This is one of those nightmares you wish never was going to happen. Of all times, this is the membership drive for KELW. So why in the world would you want to talk to somebody to give money to a station who can't even get his wife on the phone? And yet I invite you while I'm waiting, if you do listen to public radio and you value it being non-commercial, especially if you like work with Marty Nemko, we'd invite you very much to consider being a member or renewing your membership in KLW. And we have a very special inducement. You can get to come to brunch with Barbara and me on June 14th, here at KELW. You get to sit in on the show, and we have a lovely brunch. You can ask all kinds of questions and whatever, and, you know, get a career makeover and tell us what you want on the show and network with each other and maybe find a good job. In any case, why don't I just give out the phone number? That's going to be the end of this. I'm not going to pitch anymore. We're going to go right to my wife, who apparently is now on the line. The phone number, if you would like to come to brunch, it's $150 for one person, $250 for a couple. It's 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917, or you can do it at kalw.org. And now, Barbara Nemko, were you able to hear the introduction? Are you there? Are you there?
I certainly am.
Good. Well, we've solved the problem, and thank you, dear listeners, for your patience in enduring the wait. You did hear the introduction. Okay. So, for a decade now, Google has been studying what attributes most lead to a productive employee. What are they?
They call them general cognitive ability, which is another way of saying smart. Leadership.
Smart is defined by what?
As defined by what? People who can learn and adapt to new situations, because you can teach somebody to do something that they do over and over and over again, but that isn't today's work life. All kinds of things come up. For example, this morning we got cut off. So that's a new situation that you have to figure out what went wrong and how are you going to make it right. And that's something that's it's much harder to teach.
When I read the book, they really did use standard measures of cognitive functioning, whether it be the GRE or your, there are standard tests of ability to reason rigorously. They can't use the word IQ anymore. But that was what they were referring to as general cognitive ability. What was the second one that was listed in the book?
The second one is leadership, but not just leadership, because they include the potential. So maybe you're not a leader right now, but if you have the potential to do that, what they're talking about is in different situations, different people may take a leadership role. So if the group is working on some kind of a problem, somebody may take the leadership role in doing the major part of writing it up, while somebody else might take the leadership role in doing the presentation because they're better in oral communication.
Yeah. And we're going to, in a minute, we're going to see, I think, I might as well mention it now. You know, they do assess that, not just by past performance, but they do use job simulations and see how well people can take leadership in a situation that's set up for them.
They do.
What's the third one? The third attribute
is what they call googliness. And when you hear that, it kind of makes you smile. So you think it all has to do with having fun and being somebody who gets along really well, but it also has to do with being very conscientious and getting the job done, being comfortable with ambiguity, because in this day and age, so much is ambiguous. So it's not only that you have a good time.
And the fourth attribute is, ironically, is the one they call least important. And that is what?
Role-related knowledge. And the reason that they say it's the least important is that because you've done something over many years and you know how to do it, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's exactly the way they're going to want you to do it in your new job. And your new job may have elements of what you've done in the past, but there may be some of this ambiguity that creeps in. So they don't want somebody who is going to be so set in their ways because they've always been successful doing it this way. They're very much about finding ways for employees to contribute and to come up with their best ideas. They're not about managers thinking that they know everything and telling their supervisees how to do a job.
Of course, also really, you know, very often we hear that what matters is not so much the specific knowledge. Of course, if you're a software engineer who's going to be programming in Ruby on Rails, you need to know how to program in Ruby on Rails, but very often far less important than there being a rock star in that in a particular hard skill is the ability, yes, to be smart, to be conscientious, which is one of the big things that that Google talks about. And so,
well, not that I know what Ruby on Rails is, but I would say that they would say it's very fine to be a smart engineer who knows how to program in Ruby on Rails, but maybe somebody will come up with a different way to program.
You know, I want to talk a little bit. I really love what the section of the book was on interviewing and selection. And so I'm going to share, and then I'm just going to get your reactions, because you hire people all the time. So, Laszlo Bock, in that book, Work Rules, he says that Google has concluded that most interviews are useless. And he does that. He's not just shooting from the hip when he says that. A meta-analysis of 85 years of research on how well assessments predict performance, which is, after all, what it's all about, found that unstructured job interviews explain just 14% of variation in performance. Reference checks, just 7%. And just get this, 3% experience. So that was why I was reacting earlier. The notion experience really... they would much rather have somebody who is not experienced, but who has got those earlier skills you talked about, general cognitive ability, leadership with the potential to do that, and conscientiousness. So what does Google do? They use 29, they have this quantified in general on average, although it varies with the job, 29% of what their determination of how they hire is based on work samples. 26% on general cognitive ability, that is smarts, how well you can reason abstractly, think on your feet, etc. And then third, critically, an assessment of conscientiousness, which is, you know, how well they have been able to handle difficult, long tasks in the past, and again, in the job simulations that Google gives. And they also use GPA as an indicator of how well you're willing to persist through sometimes pain in the butt, long, hard stuff, even if it's not intrinsically rewarding. What, as you listen to that, Barbara, as a superintendent of schools, that's what they do at Google. What is your honest reaction to how applicable any of that is to the more real-world kind of job situation like you have at the Napa County Office of Education?
Well, I think that one of the tests that they do, the structured interviews where they ask candidates questions that have really clear criteria, so they're using a rubric to determine whether or not the quality of the answers are really good. And there are two kinds of structured interviews that they do that I just love that we could do, behavioral and situational. So the behavioral is in the past. That's where you ask a candidate to describe their previous achievements. But you don't say, tell me your previous achievements, and then the candidate gives you some memorized set of, well, I led the team and our sales went up 38%. That's not what they're talking about. They say things like, tell me about a time when you were dealing with a difficult employee. Someone that you were supervising or someone that you were supposed to be collaborating with, and tell me how you handled it. Or they would say, that's behavioral. And then the situational, very similar, but it's a future thing. What would you do if this happened?
And, right, those certainly the future ones are much harder to prep for. But the reality is, and this is something I found interesting in the book, that even it's a pretty standard question to say, tell me about a problem situation you faced in the past and how you deal with it. Well, many, many job interviewees have been prepped for that. And so, but at least they find at Google that even though you can prep for it, there is a big range in how thoughtful people are, how well they communicated, how subtle. And so, because normally, even if, let's say, a job candidate has hired a resume coach or a job interview coach, those job interview coaches are not so high-powered themselves, and their answer may not begin to represent the excellence that a good employer is looking for. So even a common question like, tell me about a problem you faced in the past and how you dealt with it, even if it's been prepped, you can learn a lot about the candidate. That was fascinating to me that they said that in Google.
Well, the other thing that was fascinating was that they write down your answers. And that way somebody can look at your answers. They can go back and look at your answers at another time and see how you responded, so that if somebody isn't there for the interview, other people can take a look at it. You can open it up to a wider range of people, and then you can see how consistently the people on the interview panel rated the person. Mm-hmm. And then you have something to discuss because you've actually written down their answers. But let me give you a couple.
Before you do that, though, two things. One is it is valuable. To compare, you've got, by the time you finish interviewing, you've interviewed seven or eight people, and then they all begin to sound the same, and you begin to forget what number one said, number two, and if you've got the written transcript of what each of them said, and if you've got a standard set of questions, you can compare them, which can really help you a lot in making a judgment and defending that judgment.
Right. Plus, they also talk about the fact that we all have unconscious biases.
Right.
And we tend to ask questions that will elicit responses that validate our unconscious bias or at least reinforce it. So the candidate will give an answer and you'll think, oh, yeah, that's just what I would do. And so now you're sure that that's the right person because that person is so similar to you, but maybe
right.
That's not what you're looking for.
Right.
And I love the kinds of questions. So here's an interview question that's behavioral. So tell me about the time your behavior had a positive impact on your team.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, that could be easy, but then there are follow-ups. So what was your primary goal here and why? How did your teammates respond? What did you do with somebody who perhaps did not go along with the program?
Mm-hmm.
Moving forward, what's
mm-hmm.
your plan? So it isn't just the initial question, it's the follow-up questions that get at things.
Love it. Dear listeners, whether you are a job seeker and you are hearing, this is really, we're going into the belly of the beast. We are looking into the mind of what good interviewers do. Of course, there are crappy interviewers on some employers. But this should help you ratchet up your game if you're a job seeker. And if you are a manager and a hiring person, it should help ratchet up your hiring. Because there is nothing. If it's one thing I've read again and again, 1,000 times, in books on leadership and management and whatever, the single most important thing that a manager does is hire wisely. And that's
not
why we're doing
wisely. Hire. They're very big on always hire people smarter than you are.
Very true. And if you are finding this interesting, my dear listeners, twice a year, only twice a year, and really for only a total of 1 hour, that is right now, we ask you to donate to KELW and to work with Marty Nemco. If you like work with Marty Nemco, either because you like the interviews that we do, whether with my, Barbara and me or with my kind of eminent guests, I'll be talking to a really interesting guy who's an orthodontist later in the show, or we've interviewed everything from prostitutes to psychiatrists. We've had debates on the issues of the day that relate to work. We're going to be talking about job training next week. Does it really work? Does it not? We're going to have a great debate. If you like that kind of diversity, ideological diversity, and you care about work and you want to support work with Marty Nemco, this is the only time you get to do it. And I value your support tremendously. And to show you that, we, my wife, Barbara Nemco, and I, Barbara was here on the phone, want to meet you and have you come to Brunswick. So instead of the usual thank you gift, here is a keychain. We invite you to come to brunch with us on June 14th. You can get to come. If you want, you can come and sit in the show that morning. And then we have a lovely brunch here, and you can network with folks. You can ask us questions about your career. You can tell us what you'd like on the show. And most of all, maybe, it's fun. And it's for a $150 donation to KEOW. One of you can come. $250, a bargain for two of you. The phone number here to play. We really value your support and KELW. We at work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, as well as KELW. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Just takes a minute or two. We have lovely KELW volunteers. They'll take your credit card or whatever. Or if you'd prefer to do it online, just go to KELW.org. We value you enormously. Barbara, what do you want to say, if anything?
I want to say that in addition to all of the above, the food is delicious.
Right.
We promise to feed you well. And it's always fun. If you listen to the show, you have some image of what the studio looks like, what the broadcasting is like, who works there, what we look like. So it's fun. It's fun to meet people that you've listened to and have never seen in person.
Hey, I just found out.
There are lots of people who come more than once.
Hey, I just found out that there is some the lovely listeners of KELW have issued a challenge. Up to $300. So if you say, for example, let's say two of you come as a couple, your $250 will be matched and it'll be $500.
Wow.
It gets donated. So this is a great time to call so that your money goes twice as far. And I profound, each dollar is a vote for Work with Marty Nemco for non-commercial public radio. This is a growing and interesting station that is really trying to make a difference for the people of San Francisco. It is all local and all independent, not corporate donations. It's really about you. 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. And if you can't afford the brunch, the basic membership, I believe, is still $60. I'm not 100% sure. You can get that way. You get the program guide and you get the good feeling and some thank you gifts. 1-800-525-9917. And one of the other things we love to do here is keep the pledge, the request for money short. So we're going to end it. We're going to go back now to talking with you, Barbara, about Work Rules, the book by Google's head of HR. So,
may I give you another example of a question that I thought was really fun?
Sure. This is now for those listeners who are just joining us. This is a question that that Google likes to ask its possible candidates to get hired, for getting hired.
Okay. So here, tell me about a time when you effectively managed your team to achieve a goal.
Mm-hmm.
What did your approach look like? And then follow-up questions would be, what were your targets and how did you meet them as an individual? And as a team.
Okay, Barbara. All this is good in theory. I'm going to you answer the question yourself. Tell me a time you managed a team at the Napa County Office of Education and all the positive outcomes and maybe the negative outcomes. Let's hear it, Doc.
Okay. I didn't expect this question. I just
no, of course not.
That.
Not too bad.
I wanted to implement digital early literacy at Napa County because I think it is perhaps the game changer for closing the achievement gap because so many kids come to school and they're more than 2 years behind when they get to kindergarten, and that gap persists all the way through school.
How'd you lead your team? The question you said was, how did you lead your team?
Well, I had to give you a context.
Okay.
So I can tell
I'm
you
just being a tough interviewer.
So then I brought together the people who would be most involved in that, and that included the deputy superintendent, the head of early childhood, and some of the other managers in early childhood. And we talked about why I thought it was important and what it looked like, and that was kind of to get them motivated and on board. But it's challenging because then you have to get all 16 early childhood teachers to decide they want to do this on an iPad, where early childhood teachers tend to think screen time is bad. So we invited them all in, and we gave them the same presentation about why it was so important, what a difference it would make for their kids. We showed a video of some kids actually using it, and we gave each of them an iPad, and we said, we're not going to ask you to do this right now. We want you to get familiar with the iPad. We're going to give you professional development. Here are these opportunities when we'll help you learn about it. And then you'll have the whole summer to play with it and feel really comfortable. And then in the fall, we want you to start implementing. So we did it in stages. Mm-hmm. We did it with a lot of support. We said we will provide coaches in the classroom to help, because it's harder to actually implement it than to talk about implementing it or to do it when you're all alone by yourself. And then we said, okay, the people who use it the most are going to get a reward. You'll get something, you can buy school supplies for kids. So that was how we got it implemented.
Now, what I found interesting is two things. First of all, the answer felt it was substantive and detailed, but it was long. I'm wondering and I'm wondering also whether you would, it strikes me odd that teachers would, for something as kind of seemingly simple as using software on an iPad with kids, that it would require all that begging, all that cajoling, all that stages, all those rewards, all that training. Tell me, does that surprise you, actually?
No, because most people in the field of early childhood, at least the ones who've been in it for a long time, and most of our people have been in it for a long time, have heard all the studies about television and screen time. And iPads, although we think of them as having been around forever, only became available in 2010.
You mean that there was, but you mean,
or been here forever.
Your earlier statement was, you mean really that people have been told it's bad for young children to spend much time in front of a screen.
Right. Yeah. And so there is that bias. And if you're saying to teachers now, we want you to change your practice and include what they think of as screen time with an instrument, an iPad that they're not terribly familiar with, and entirely change what their day looks like, that's a big deal.
Okay. So how would you rate your answer? Let's say you were, look inward now. And I care about my listeners, and I want my listeners to see, because you hire all the time. If somebody gave you that answer to the question, would you rate it excellent, good, fair, or poor, and why?
I would ask a follow-up question, and I'd say, how successful have you been?
Let's say they said it was a failure. Let's say they said it was, we tried it, we thought it was really smart, but it ended up the teachers resisted, and they continue, they really wouldn't change their attitude, they really feel kids should play, and they didn't want to, in the end, most of them kind of passively, aggressively avoided using the iPads. How would you evaluate that answer?
I would say, then, what's your next step? What are you going to do? What's your plan?
I think sometimes, I don't know, I love to hear about, I love integrity. I think integrity is the big piece of that's missing from job interviews. It's been said that a job interview are two people lying to each other. And I think that the notion...
Oh, that's a cynical statement.
Yeah. The employer is saying how great the job is, and the employee is saying how wonderful he or she is. I would welcome hearing somebody admit a failure, but that lessons learned from the failure and the smarts about all that, than somebody who's going to continually beating the horse. After all that you described that they were doing in the school, you would to make this thing work, and after all that expenditure of money, there was still this massive resistance. It feels weird I'm not sure it would be an excellent stewardship of money to say, well, now we're going to keep flogging this horse in another way.
Well, wait, who said, there are two questions there. You're making an assumption that there was massive resistance. That's one.
No, I'm just saying,
and
if
two,
there were.
You're saying that you're talking about flogging a dead horse. Actually, the horse is alive and well, and it's a great horse.
I understand, but I was saying if there was. Okay.
It.
All right. Let's turn to. You're listening to Work with Martin Amcoe and Barbara Amcoe. We're talking about the book written by the head of people operations, that's HR at Google, Laszlo Bock. And one of the things he also talks about is training. So I want to. Do you want to talk about the. Why don't you talk? What does Bock say about training employees?
Well, I think the most interesting thing is that he says 90% of training doesn't bring about improvement or change. talk about.
Sustained
difficult.
Improvement. Short-term,
so
yes, but a phase. Yeah.
But when they do have to train on something, they don't have the manager come in and do all the training. They try to use colleagues, your fellow workers, because people tend to react better to somebody that they feel is like them than they do to somebody who they feel doesn't really understand their situation or why it would be so hard to do.
Right, right.
So they pick and they pick different people. So it isn't always the same person. It depends on what they're teaching and who's the best at that thing to do the training. And then they do lots of things besides just telling. They do role-playing. They do video role-playing. And then they look at the videos and they figure out what's going well and what isn't going well. And then they assess what performance changes actually happened and how was the result different.
I particularly like the idea of videoing role-playing. We learn a lot from watching ourselves. There's a reason that if you are taking golf lessons or whatever, they are videoing you so you can see what you're doing wrong. It's one thing to be told it, but if you can see it, you're more likely to change. And the same thing if you're doing a training, say, on management communication styles, and you get, you know, it's one thing you're involved in it, but if you then see a video of yourself in action and see you're too intense or too slow or too interruptive or too critical or too nice, seeing it may be much more indelible than the actual role play itself. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think that that is a brilliant thing to do. And in fact, that's the thing that we really need to be doing so much more with teaching, is videoing people as they're teaching, because we do so many things unconsciously because we've always done it that way or because our teachers did it that way. And that's true of any job. But when you see yourself suddenly, you go, oh, my God, I didn't realize I did that.
Absolutely.
Or look at so-and-so. Look how that person did it. That's so effective. I want to do it that way.
When I was doing faculty development, one of the models we liked the best was to have people paired, faculty members in the same departments, and they would be paired and watch each other, and they would video it, and then they would debrief the video with each other in the conference. And everything, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happened in there in those videos was not for accountability. It was for personal development, professional development. So the idea of watching a video and then reviewing it together, I think, is a very, very potent approach. And dear listeners, it's not expensive anymore. Everybody's got a webcam. Camcorders cost next to nothing. I know it's really scary to reveal yourself in front of a peer, but I'm looking here at Ken Dillahay, who's an orthodontist, and I would bet my life that even though he is eminent, and we'll talk to him in a minute, if he was video doing a difficult procedure and sharing that with somebody else who was another with a peer, and then they reversed roles, that both of them, even though he's been doing this for 33 years, I bet my life that Ken would be a better orthodontist as a result. So, dear listeners, whether you are a clerk or you're a CEO, I invite you to screw your courage to the sticking place and ask somebody you respect to co-coach each other so there's no hierarchy involved. Each of you are peers trying to help each other. Does that make sense, Barbara Nemco?
Oh, absolutely, and you don't need a camcorder. Everybody's got an iPhone today with a camera.
Exactly.
You can hand it to a kid and say, would you just press this button and videotape me teaching this lesson?
Good point.
For 5 minutes, and then you send it to your colleague across the hall, and she sends you one, and that would be true in any profession, and you just take a look at it side by side, and you see what you like, what you don't like, and you can have some criteria that you're looking for.
Good point. I'm feeling inclined to do a one-minute pitch break here. So, dear listeners, this is KLW's one time in 6 months that we come asking you. You'll never hear a commercial here, right? You notice you're listening to radio. You're going to have a whole hour. There's no commercials. And 52 weeks a year, there are no commercials. You are not interrupted. We're also not bought off. We are not at all beholden to anyone other than you, our dear listeners. And because we are here only for you, we have to come to you. We'd rather get the money from you to run a radio station than we would going to a big fat cat sponsor where you might feel obliged. So I invite you to call if you or if you have benefited or someone you love has benefited from listening. Either it's entertaining, you like Barbara Nemco, you hate my guts, you like the diversity of radio that really does occur here on KALW, from Marty Nemco to Jim Hightower, I invite you to call. And we'd like to thank you because, we're about giving back to you. We have donated, Barbara and I have donated a brunch. where you get to come to the studio on June 14th and sit in the show if you want, right here in the studio. Afterwards, we have a lovely brunch. We are open to input, feedback. You need help with your career, we do that. We go around the room, we laugh, we network. $150 for one person, $250 for two, and you'll have the good feeling of supporting Work with Marty Nemco. It's the only chance to do it. This is just only now. And supporting KLW and non-commercial public radio, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And now, entering the studio...
Wait, may I just say one thing before
sure.
you sign off?
I'm not signing off.
A show like... sign off with me. A show like today, where you may have picked up some hiring tips, could save you and your business hundreds of thousands of dollars from not...
Or nonprofit or hire. Government agency. Go ahead.
And every week... There are different kinds of tips that you get. So to say, yeah, that was really helpful, any contribution would be wonderful, come to the brunch would be spectacular, and if you can't bear to do the contribution right now because you want to listen to the rest of the show, then you can do it after. But please, if you do it after, please say this is for Work with Marty Nemco.
That would be very nice. And now I'd like to welcome our fearless leader, the station manager here at KLW, Matt Martin.
I do have fears occasionally, Marty, I have to say. I just try to confront them. But, you know, this is a cooperative effort. The station is diverse. The station gives you a range of programming, music, arts, culture, of course, news from the NPR and CBC and BBC, but also a program like Marty Nemco. And Work with Marty Nemco is not a program you'll hear on every public radio
station. Or any public radio station.
You hear it right here.
Yeah.
And if you value it, if you listen, now is the time to show your support for this program and the mosaic of programs on KALW. We are here not to just sustain this public radio station, but to grow it. And your support at 800-525-9917 or KALW.org, where you can learn more about the brunch with Marty and Barbara. You can look at other thank you gifts as well. But the most important thing is to understand that every single person makes a difference by participating in these campaigns. And right now is a great time to do it because if you're listening, you must be finding something of value. That is why you're here, and we're here together to keep it strong. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
Here's what I really believe. We all are being hit up for money from a million nonprofits. And here is my honest case for why KALW and Work with Marty Nemco deserves a spot. It's not, you don't give all your money to KLW. Don't. It'll be a bad idea. But why I believe it's worthy of a spot in your charity dollars, because in the end, that's what this is. We push away all the stuff. It's charity. Why? The world changes because of the hearts and minds of human beings. If they believe strongly enough to become an activist in something, if they want to change their workplace because they hear about a better way to run the work for employees, for shareholders, for everybody, for managers, for workers... That matters. And we are, and public radio is unbiased. You know, it is, we all have our biases, but it's not on the take. There are certain media that's on the take, and I can swear to you that KLW is not on the take. And so if you want to contribute to enlightening the hearts and minds of activism, wherever it is on the political spectrum or in the helper spectrum or whatever, I invite you to come to brunch with us because it's really fun and it's not a cattle call. It's going to be 10 people usually. And you will benefit and you will change the hearts and minds of people in the Bay Area. It doesn't get better than that. 1-800-525-9917. Or go to KALW.org.
800-525-9917, KALW.org. If you've never given to public radio, if you've never given to KALW before, now is a time, and I think that what you're talking about, Marty, the sense of you want information and ideas, you want an exchange, and you want then to be able to go and do something about
it.
Well, participating in your local media, trying to say, like, yeah, let's maintain this non-commercial space that is independent, where there is the freedom for a wide variety of voices. Your support makes that possible. And I know we want to go back to the program. We want to hear more of the conversation Marty has, but you sustain it. And so while we ask, it makes a great difference if you come across.
Very good. Matt Martin, thanks very much for
coming.
Thanks,
Marty.
Right. Okay. And now one more quick question for Barb, because you've got to go, I know. And then I have a wonderful guest here that I'd like to introduce. But, you know, something that I guess we should end on the fun note. What the heck? Google provides these various nudges to influence their employees' choices. They don't mandate stuff. They nudge. Give me an example. I'll give you an example, and then you can go and comment on it. All right. I guess I read the book more carefully than you did. I like.
No, you just took me by surprise. I thought I was leaving.
No, I can't leave me. You are never leaving, Barbara. You are my wife and my life forever. But you'll be, yes, we'll be leaving in 2 minutes. I know you got to go. But here's the deal. Every workplace now, big workplace, says, we want a healthy workforce. And so they tell you, go eat your broccoli, not your cheeseburgers.
Oh, but, right.
But a much,
so they do clever things, like they reduce the size of the plates in the cafeteria.
Right.
Instead of 12-inch plates, which we've all become so accustomed to, now it's 9-inch plates.
Also heard under the radar that, I don't know, that they do something else.
And yes, they take the healthy foods and they show it in containers that you can see what they are so that they look really good and you say, oh, I'll have that. And the unhealthy foods and the candy bars, they put them under wraps so you can't really see it and it doesn't tempt you.
Right. Also, I don't know if Google does this, but, you know, we go to Sweet Tomatoes for these wonderful buffet meals, these like salad buffets.
Mm-hmm.
They have changed the plates. They didn't change the size of the plate. They changed the size of the rim of the plate.
Right.
So it was a 12-inch thing with, used to have a 3/4-inch rim. Now it's a 12-inch plate with a 1.5-inch rim, so that the actual plate size that doesn't go on the rim is like tiny. And so there are subtle ways that everybody is trying to manipulate you in one way or the other. So certainly beware of that.
Those are good manipulations.
Those are good manipulations. Well, Barbara, thank you for letting me manipulate you to being on the show, and I know you're very, very busy. Can we tell the truth of why you have to get off the phone? Maybe
yes,
we should.
Yes, because we're having 25 people over here, and they don't know that they're going to be surprised. They're coming for brunch, but they don't know that at 2 o'clock the Napa High School Choir is going to come and entertain them.
Well, you've just blown the surprise. Now, anybody who's listening to the show is going to 25. They're going to just...
They're not listening. They're getting dressed. I'm not worried about that.
You're right.
They're on their way. And so we bid on that because it's hard to support music departments. You have to do it through fundraisers. And so we try to bid every year and be the highest bidder to get the choir to come and sing.
Well, very good.
That's why. So I got to go get ready for 26 people. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah?
Well, thank you. No, I'll let you go. I look forward to seeing you
bye-bye.
As soon as we finish doing this wonderful show. I'm now excited about the next part. But I love you, Barb. Bye-bye. Okay. No, I don't love my next guest. I like my next guest. You know, I do a semi-regular segment on this show called What's It Really Like to Be a Whatever? And I've done everything from psychiatrists to prostitutes. But today, a little less sexy, I must admit, but you're going to find it interesting and fun, I think. What's it really like to be an orthodontist? You know, those people who put braces on your teeth? This is going to be a bracing interview, I promise. I know, it's disgusting. Yes, you know, there's the obvious things. They get paid quite well. You know, I actually heard that the average orthodontist makes $300,000 a year. And, yeah, they have another advantage. They don't get middle-of-the-night emergency calls. Doctor, I need my rubber bands adjusted. But I do think you'll find my guest interesting. Even if you have no interest in entering the career of orthodonture, takes a lot of time, actually, about 3 years after dental school. 2 years, maybe 2 years, something like that. But in any case, and maybe hopefully you will never need a dental appliance. What made me do this segment is the American Association of Orthodontists is having its convention right here, right now, San Francisco. And I've extracted, so to speak, an orthodontist that I think you're going to find particularly interesting. He is Dr. Ken Dillahay. He's been an orthodontist for 33 years. And his son liked it so much, and him, I guess, so much, that his kid chose to become an orthodontist and even joined his dad's practice. Ken was Kansas Dentist of the Year, Advocate of the Year from the American Student Dental Association, and winner of the Service Above Self Award. Big deal from Rotary. My wife is a proud member as well. Ken's hobby? Hanging out at a lake called, catch this, Alveolar Ridge. That's the ridge right behind your upper teeth. Dr. Ken Dillahay, welcome to Work with Marty Nemco.
Marty, thank you for having me on the show. I look forward to it.
Well, good. So, I promise not to pull teeth.
Well, that's good. It looks like you're working pretty hard for a couple of jokes there.
you're absolutely right. So, do you recall a moment when you actually first decided to be an orthodontist?
Actually, I do. I was in middle school, and there was a young man that I'd grown up with who had some really crooked teeth, and he went through the brace process and had those braces removed, and it just made an incredible difference in his life. All the pretty girls started hanging around him, and he became much more engaged, much better student, became a stud on the football field, and I was thinking, wow. That makes a huge difference. I just couldn't believe the self-confidence that he acquired around that period of his life, and I think a lot of it had to do with his orthodontics.
I believe it. You know, I used to be somebody who was very anti-plastic cosmetic surgery because I felt it was a bad use of medical resources and whatever. But I have seen some people who have had cosmetic surgery, and it changed their lives. One woman who had a breast reduction. All people could do is all they could do was see her breasts all the time, and now she was viewed as a whole person. Somebody who was aging and very self-conscious about it and in a very public position and got a facelift, and it changed everything. You know, we spend all this money on clothing and a bunch of this other stuff, and we don't think twice about it. But changing your smile, for example, from one with crooked teeth that make you look like a yokel from rural Arkansas to somebody who doesn't, you know, isn't distracting looking like that, can make a big difference. It makes sense to me. It really does. Do you ever recall like a favorite patient that you've ever had?
You know, I've had an opportunity to treat an awful lot of beauty queens and local celebrities, politicians, community leaders, and that really is rewarding. But I'm in a stage of my career. I've practiced for 33 years. The opportunity to give back is something that I have a great sense of commitment to. And many times we have children who don't have the resources, don't have the access, don't have the ability to have orthodontic treatment. And our national organization provides a service called Donated Orthodontic Services, and it helps children in certain economic areas get orthodontic treatment that's really going to be beneficial to them. And when we have an opportunity to meet and treat one of those end up being some of my most favorite patients, because you really, truly make a difference in that child's life.
What I found interesting is when I asked for a specific patient, you gave me a broad generality. Do they all blend together after a while? Is there no patient that comes to mind?
Well, no, not specifically as an individual patient. There are many examples, and we could talk for a long period of time about favorites, but being able to provide something for someone that can't provide it for themselves is a favorite patient.
You know, when we talked before the show, I was surprised. One of the things that surprised me is that, you know, you actually suggest that kids come in at age 7 for a pre-exam. I remember that when I was growing up, it was all the 10 and 11-year-olds would be going to the orthodontist. Why 7-year-olds? Is this just a money grab from you guys, or what's the deal?
Well, about age 7, the incisor teeth, the front teeth are starting to erupt, and the back molars have erupted, and it gives us an opportunity to really assess and evaluate a couple of things. Number one, do we have enough room in the mouth for the teeth to grow in? And number two, are the jaws the same length and the same width? And if those three things are, in fact, present, and many times you can determine that to a great extent at an age 7, that child's likely to grow their teeth in, and they're likely to fit together in a pretty reasonable manner. And if, in fact, one or more of those three things is not going on or not correct, it gives us an opportunity to intervene and prevent a much worse problem from occurring. So,
in other words,
you
can have shorter treatment if you start at 7 than if you wait till 10 or 11?
Well, not necessarily just shorter, but better and more comprehensive treatment.
Okay. Let's go to the other end of the age continuum. If I were, let's say, you know, in my 60s, and I came in and I got crooked teeth, how would my first visit with you be different from a 7-year-old coming in with crooked teeth?
Well, as we said a second ago, you have an opportunity in a 7-year-old to prevent things, intercept things, change things. With a 60, 70-year-old patient, many times you're dealing with the facts of the matter, and your ability to intercept or prevent things certainly isn't there, and it gives us an opportunity. And I think the primary difference would be, what can we do to restore and recover things that have occurred during their lifetime? And so it is a much different conversation.
What's the most common reason somebody at 75 comes in, and what can you actually do realistically for him or her?
Many times people will present to us at a point in their life when their teeth are vulnerable. And they're looking at maybe having the remaining teeth that they have removed and wearing a prosthetic, a denture.
Right.
And maybe they don't want to do that.
Sure.
And so they seek us out to put the teeth back into a position so that their family dentist can replace missing or worn or broken down teeth. And then many times we work with our dental specialty colleagues and periodontics, gum specialists, to help maintain the gum and bone support around those teeth. So they're just not ready to trade in their teeth for denture.
And is that a reasonable, fair? I mean, if let's say I have these teeth that are very malocluded, and my local dentist is saying, I think we really should pull this out and give you dentures, and I'm saying, oh, I don't want dentures. That's polydent old man stuff. I want to.
It is.
Yeah, I know. Right. So I want to, I want to go and see you. What is the probability you can be able to help me and keep my teeth without having to go, be Mr. Gums?
Well, if you asked me that question 33 years ago, I'd say, there's a limit to what we have in terms of resources and technology and experience and techniques. But today, there are so many other things that we have available to us and things that we've learned over time and the experience of the providers.
One specific, please. What's a specific thing you might do now that you couldn't have done 30 years ago?
Implants.
Okay.
Implants. Actually, go through the gum tissue into the bone. They sit for a bit, and they anchor to the bone. And then you can affix and attach multiple dentures, bridges, crowns to those implants.
That's still those are different. Those aren't your teeth, though. Those are still denture-like things. They're just not.
Not necessarily. They could be removable, or they could be permanent.
And they still, you keep your teeth,
depending on the number of teeth you have, you could supplement the number of teeth you have with some implants and then have a permanent restoration so that it puts you back to square one virtually.
I want to get a window into what it's, I always feel like the diagnostic process is the window into any, not just healthcare, whether you're an auto mechanic or a psychiatrist. Let's try to get into the mind of an orthodontist. If I come in, I understand that one of the most common things that somebody comes to an orthodontist about is TMJ, jaw pain. As they use the technical term, the differential, how do you go about it determining what's the cause of that pain and then therefore the treatment? What goes through your head?
Marty, just for your listening audience, when you talk about TMJ, it refers to the joint directly in front of your ear. It's the hinge. It's your jaw joint, so to speak. And that hinge or that jaw joint many times has a relationship to the way that your teeth fit together. So there can be many maladies that create a dysfunction or disharmony with the way the hinge or the jaw joint works just based on whether your teeth fit together well. Do you have missing teeth? Do you have broken down teeth? Are your teeth absent? And many times there are associated maladies, headaches, earaches, jaw pain, popping, clicking noises associated with that hinge or that jaw joint. And so the diagnosis of that is pretty complex and probably not part of the radio show today. But orthodontists and the specialists that have 2 to 3 years of additional training after dental school are really trained to really look at those issues and diagnose and treat them.
So in the limited time we have, let's turn to the career itself, not so much the practice. If now imagine you're talking to people who are thinking about being an orthodontist or whose kids were or whatever. What no BS, is the real best and worst thing about being an orthodontist?
Well, the best thing is easy because it's getting up and going to work every day and knowing that you're going to change someone's life, just like the young individual I talked about a minute ago. I see that on a daily basis. I take braces off of an individual sometimes more than twice a day, and to see the change when they look in that mirror for the first time, I mean, that's why I get up and that's why I go to work. The most difficult part or the worst part of our job is basically the stress associated with staying on schedule and getting kids in and out of the office.
Interesting.
They have so many activities and so many extracurricular activities anymore that it makes it difficult to get them in there. There's a partnership between the parents. There's a partnership between the child and maintaining their appliances, taking care of them, making sure they don't break their appliances. There's the team aspect of the team members associated with providing that care in the individual office. The doctor has a role in that. So coordinating all that and ending up at the point where you want to be in a reasonable period of time and the stress associated with that, that's really the worst part.
Makes sense. So if I were your son and I said, Dad, and I know your son is obviously in your practice with you, but I say, Dad, I'm thinking about becoming an orthodontist. What would you tell me that only a parent would tell his kid?
Well, I would tell you that if you were my son, you obviously know that I have a lot of friends in the medical community and in other areas of medicine and healthcare, especially if you're interested specifically in healthcare. And what my medical colleagues tell me is, and these are some of the best providers in neurology or neurosurgery or cardiology, and they're sending their children to dental school. They're recommending that they go to dental school because of the profession and because of the reputation, because of the ability to change things. And I think the first thing out of my mouth to tell you would be to say, wonderful, what can I do to help you? Now, aside from that, I would want to sit down with you and talk about what's required and what the hurdles are, and sometimes a bit about what the benefits and rewards are.
So any other hurdles that are not obvious that you want to share with our listeners?
I think the most obvious hurdle that we see as specialists in orthodontics is that we have, as you mentioned in your opening remarks, 3 years of additional training past dental school. And I think that for the most part, a lot of folks in your listening audience think that most people that can put braces on are all the same, and that they don't realize that we do go to dental school. We are dentists first. We spend 4 years in dental school. We generally graduate at the top of our class. And typically, we would make awfully fine dentists, but we've chosen to go on and seek additional training. And most people, I think, don't really understand that the people who are really specialists in orthodontics have that additional training.
Here's something I would worry about. I'm seeing a real move in this nation toward making medical care a publicly funded, a taxpayer-funded entity. And in the arc of my life, if I am first going into orthodontics now, and I'm looking at 3 years of expensive dental school and 2 to 3 years of a residency in orthodonture, I'm looking at a mammoth amount of debt. And if, in fact, we go public sector, I could see the pay being so low that I may never pay back my damn student loans, let alone making a good income. Is that a realistic worry?
It absolutely is, but it's not just unique to orthodontics. It's
right.
Unique to dentistry. It's unique to teachers.
Right.
It's unique to people who have bachelor's degrees. And it's,
well, but teaching has always been in public sector. That's been established, and the training is only 18 months after bachelor's degree. Here we're talking about a $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 investment in your dental training, and then right now orthodontists are making $300,000 a year. But if it becomes a public sector thing, it could be $100,000 a year, and you've got this mammoth amount of student debt. That's my worry. Is that reasonable to worry about?
It absolutely is, and it's not that. You know, perhaps if you look at a survey, and we all see the highs and the lows, and we all look at different geographic representation of those survey numbers, you know, that may be an accurate statement, but that's for practitioners that have been in practice for a little while. And if you look at a practitioner that's coming out and has $250,000 worth of school debt, or maybe even $500,000 worth of school debt, and they make $100,000 a year, $150,000 a year, it's an issue for us.
That is the issue. I want to end with one little softball question.
Sure.
Think back on an interview. Is there one thing we have not discussed that our listeners who are trying to get a window into what it's really like to be an orthodontist, something you haven't said that you'd like to share with us?
I think that I've touched on it a couple of different times, but the ability to see someone's life change because of what we do is so rewarding that, and if you ask me, you'll hear that. If you go down to the Moscone Convention Center, and by the way, your city's done such a wonderful job of hosting us here. We have almost 17,000 people associated with our national meeting, and we have over 5,000 doctors here. And you go and interview those, they'll tell you basically that same thing. It's that ability to have an effect on a child's life and change them.
Yeah, sounds pretty exciting. Well,
it is.
Hopefully changed our listeners, at least entertained and edified them a bit. Dr. Ken Dillahaye, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Marty, thanks for the invitation.
Now, I have a PR person sitting here. Is there anything that was important for the general public to know that would be of value in terms of orthodonture? Let's put her on for just a moment. Priscilla?
I echo what Dr. Dillahaye said. Smiles change lives, and the orthodontists do it every day, and it's so impactful.
Thank you very much. Okay, dear listeners, you, however, can have even a greater impact potentially on human beings' lives than even an orthodontist. This is the last time, I promise you, we have 4 minutes. The last time when we have to come to you, if you like non-commercial, you've been listening to the show for a whole hour, no commercials. No, we're not bought off by anybody. We care only about you and either helping you with your career here on Work with Marty Nemco or helping to just entertain or edify you about the major issues facing society related to work. So if you would like to to support Work with Marty Nemko. This is your last chance. Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, of course. If you do, and we like to show that we're not just asking for your support, but giving it. My wife, Barbara, and Nemko and I are donating a brunch that you can come to here at KALW on June 14th. And it's $150 for one, $250 for two. It is fun, great networking. You'll get a chance to get a free career makeover from me if you wish. That's what I do normally on this show so much. The phone number, 1-800-525-9917. And there is a challenge. Remember that up to $300, if you pledge, your pledge will be matched by one of the wonderful KALW listeners. So those are the reasons to do it now, because it's not going to be around. You can't, if you want to support Work with Marty Nemko, it's got to be now, these few minutes, and you want to make the most of this challenge. Your money is matched dollar for dollar. 1-800-525-9917. I think the basic membership is $60 if the, you know, $150 a person, $250 for a couple is too much for brunch. But I think you also get thank you gifts as well. 1-800-525-9917. Takes just a minute. Talk to a friendly volunteer. Give your credit card number. Or you can go to KALW.org. But we love to see you at brunch. It's usually only about a dozen people. And so it's not some cattle call. We get a chance to interact with you individually. But I really believe that the reason to support public radio is that it is a way to not only support a show that maybe you've benefited from or enjoyed, or KALW, which you believe is of value, but I do think that the notion that radio, especially, and I'll be honest, I think if you're a little older, radio is a medium that tends to appeal particularly to people who are 50, 60, 70. There are people who are 20 and they're primarily on their podcasts. But I really think there is a place for public radio. You know, there aren't enough, I think, entertainments or edifiers that are perhaps aimed at us who are over 40 or over 50 or over 60 or over 70. So if you want to support that kind of radio, 1-800-525-9917, whether you want to come to brunch, which is really wonderful. I swear, people have come, as Barbara, my wife Barbara Nemko said earlier in the show, there are people who have come back two and three times because it's so fun. If you've ever spent $150 on something that, you know, like some people have bought a dress for $150, you will probably find that this experience of coming to brunch is well worth it at the same time as you're getting the good feeling of supporting public radio. 1-800-525-9917 is the number to donate to KALW and Work with Marty Nemko. There is literally a total of a minute and a half left, and then the opportunity both for the challenge, to meet the challenge where your donation is matched dollar for dollar, up to $300, and a chance to come to brunch with us. This is the last minute. So, you know, many of us tend to be procrastinators, and so this would be the best time to call 1-800-525-9917. Or go to KALW.org. I'm wondering, Joanne Marr, my longtime board operator, do you have something you want to honestly say that might encourage, honestly, people to pick up the phone and call and support Work with Marty Nemko and KALW during these last 30 seconds?
Well, I guess you could say Marty Nemko is a unique program, and he gives valuable advice on the air every Sunday. His three-minute makeovers, I think, have been of invaluable help to a lot of people who listen and call in, and that is just one of many reasons you should be supporting Work with Marty Nemko at 800-525-9917 or online at KALW.org. And we still have openings for Marty's brunch.
Okay. Well, I want to end then by not asking you, but thanking you. Joanne Marr, thank you for all these years of being my loyal board op here. Thank you, dear listeners, who have supported me, even with sometimes when you disagree with some of my viewpoints. I honor you for that. And, of course, I thank you very much for choosing to donate to KALW during my hour. This is the only time. And so I want to thank you all for that. But I welcome you whether you've donated or not. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I do want to thank mostly you. So please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers. And how well do taxpayer-funded job training programs work? It's a typical kind of show that I do. I'm going to moderate a debate between two excellent people on both sides. Stephen Bader directs many taxpayer-funded job training programs. He's going to advocate for them. And he's going to debate Jim Bovard, who wrote a scathing indictment of job training programs in the Wall Street Journal. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko for Barbara Nemko, who's a good reason. If you like Barbara Nemko, that's a good reason to come to brunch and pledge in 1-800-525-9917. And again, I do remind you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.